This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Flight of the Wild Gander, Explorations in the Mythological Dimension, Selected Essays 1944 to 1968, by Joseph Campbell, performed by James Anderson Foster. About the collected works of Joseph Campbell. At his death in 1987, Joseph Campbell left a significant body of published work that explored his lifelong passion, the complex of universal myths and symbols that he called mankind's one great story. He also left, however, a large volume of unreleased work, uncollected articles, notes, lectures, and diaries, as well as audio and videotape recorded lectures. The Joseph Campbell Foundation was founded in 1991 to preserve, protect, and perpetuate Campbell's work. The foundation has undertaken to archive his papers and recordings in digital format and to publish previously unavailable material and out-of-print works as the Collected Works of Joseph Campbell. The Collected Works of Joseph Campbell. Robert Walker, Executive Editor. David Kudler, Managing Editor. Introduction. The writing of the following essays occupied, or rather punctuated, a period of 24 years, during the whole course of which I was circling and, from many quarters, striving to interpret the mystery of mythology, to lift the veil, so to say, of that goddess of the ancient temple of Sais, who could say with truth and can say today and will say to the end of time, "No one has lifted my veil." The fairy tale was published in 1944 as a commentary to the Pantheon edition of Grimm's Fairy Tales, and is intended here to introduce the whole problem of the fascination, sources, preservation, and interpretation of those dreamlike images and narratives that reappear in more impressive dress in the Holy Scriptures of both the Orient and of the Occident, as well as in our higher secular arts. In Bios and Mythos, which deals with the pedagogical, actually biological, function and necessity, both of mythology and of the rites through which its images are displayed and psychologically assimilated, I have set forth my basic thesis, that myths are a function of nature as well as of culture, and as necessary to the balanced maturation of the human psyche, as is nourishment to the body. While in Primitive Man as Metaphysician, I have revived a formula first proposed by Kant for the release of the archetypal symbolic images of mythic thought from their various local matrices of culturally conditioned references and meaning so that, viewed apart from the uses to which they have been applied in the social provinces of human life, they may be recognized in themselves as natural phenomena, opening backward to mystery, like trees, like hills, or like mountain streams, antecedent, like the wood of trees, to the meanings that have been given them and the uses to which they have been put. What is the meaning of a tree, of a butterfly, of the birth of a child, or of the universe? What is the meaning of the song of a rushing stream? Such wonders simply are. They are antecedent to meaning, though meanings may be read into them. They are, as the Buddhists say, Tathagata, thus come. The Buddha himself being known as the Tathagata, the one thus come. And all things, we are told, are Buddha things. So likewise are the images of myth, which open like flowers to the conscious mind's amazement, and may then be searched to the root for meaning, as well as arranged to serve practical ends. That dream and vision have been, everywhere and forever, the chief creative and shaping powers of myth is generally recognized today by the leading students of mythic lore. The fairy tale is of the same species. In the best interpreted dreams, wrote Freud, we often have to leave one passage in obscurity because we observe during the interpretation that we have here a tangle of dream thoughts which cannot be unraveled, and which furnishes no fresh contribution to the dream content. This, then, is the keystone of the dream, the point at which it ascends into the unknown. For the dream thoughts which we encounter during the interpretation commonly have no termination, but run in all directions into the net-like entanglement of our intellectual world. It is from some denser part of this fabric that the dream wish then arises, like the mushroom from its mycelium. C.G. Jung discoursed in the same vein. A dream, like every element in the psychic structure, is a resultant of the total psyche. Hence, we may expect to find in dreams everything that has ever been of significance in the life of humanity. Just as human life is not limited to this or that fundamental instinct, but builds itself up from a multiplicity of instincts, needs, desires, and physical and psychic conditions, etc., so the dream cannot be explained by this or that element in it, however beguilingly simple such an explanation may appear to be. We can be certain that it is incorrect because no simple theory of instinct will ever be capable of grasping the human psyche, that mighty and mysterious thing, nor consequently its exponent, the dream. In order to do anything like justice to dreams, we need an interpretive equipment that must be laboriously fitted together from all branches of the human sciences. Jung developed the idea of the compensatory and projecting, guiding function of dream, and the same can be told of myth. As a rule, he remarked, the unconscious content contrasts strikingly with the conscious material, particularly when the conscious attitude tends too exclusively in a direction that would threaten the vital needs of the individual. The more one-sided his conscious attitude is, and the further it deviates from the optimum, the greater becomes the possibility that vivid dreams with a strongly contrasting but purposive content will appear as an expression of the self-regulation of the psyche. He further compared this compensatory action of the psyche to that of the body throwing off disease. Just as the body reacts purposively to injuries or infections or any abnormal conditions, so the psyche functions react to unnatural or dangerous disturbances with purposive defense mechanisms. And to that extent and end, of course, the dream, the vision, or nightmare must be said indeed to have meaning, such a meaning as that of a sneeze, the festering of an infected wound, or a fever. The teachings of a prophet will have a meaning of this kind for a whole society, to set and retain it on its path of health. However, the guiding mythic symbols, the notions of divinity, rites of praise or of atonement, festivals of accord, etc., inspired or renewed by such teachings, will have a salutary effect only so long as the circumstance prevails, or threatens to prevail, to which the teachings were addressed. A shift, for example, from a hunting to a pastoral age, or from pastoral to industrial, and the myths also will change, unless artificially retained, in which case they will themselves have become the agents of a disease, to the cure of which new visions will arise, new prophecies, new prophets, and new gods. The common tendency today to read the word myth as meaning untruth is almost certainly a symptom of the incredibility and consequent inefficacy of our own outdated mythic teachings, both of the Old Testament and of the New. The fall of Adam and Eve, tablets of the law, fires of hell, second coming of the Savior, etc. And not only of those archaic religious testaments, but also of the various more modern secular utopiates, let us call them, that are being offered today in their place. Living myths are not mistaken notions, and they do not spring from books. They are not to be judged as true or false, but as effective or ineffective, maturative or pathogenic. They are rather like enzymes, products of the body in which they work, or in homogeneous social groups, products of a body social. They are not invented, but occur, and are recognized by seers and poets, to be then cultivated and employed as catalysts of spiritual, that is, psychological, well-being. And so, finally, neither a stale and overdue nor a contrived plastic mythology will serve. Neither priest nor sociologist takes the place of the poet-seer, which, however, is what we all are in our dreams, though when we wake, we may again render only prose. Just as those not knowing the place we read in the Chandogyapanishad might walk time and again over a hidden treasure of gold without discovering it, so do all creatures here go, day by day, into that world of unconditioned being, consciousness, and bliss without discovering it, because held astray by false thoughts. Not the promise of any given myth or the claims of any inherited god, but the living source of all myths and of all the gods in their worlds is what today is holy and to be sought. And in the following pages I have sought for it, while aware nevertheless of the irony of such questing inherent in the aim itself. For as declared in the Kinupanishad, there the eye goes not, speech goes not, nor the mind. We know not, we understand not, how one might teach it. To whom it is unknown, to him it is known. The one knowing knows it not. Understood not by those that understand, it is understood by those understanding not. And in Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, those who know do not speak. Those who speak do not know. Bios and mythos and primitive man as a metaphysician treat, as said, of mythology and a production of nature, serving on one hand the biological function of fostering a wholesome maturation of the psyche, and on the other hand, the metaphysical or mystagogic function of a Buddha thing, thus come, Tathagata, opening backward to mystery. Both essays were composed and published in honor of distinguished friends, to whose works my own are deeply indebted. Bios and Mythos in 1951 for the festival volume Psychoanalysis and Culture, celebrating the 60th birthday of Geza Roheim, and Primitive Man as Metaphysician for the volume Culture and History, which appeared in 1960, in memory of the truly pioneer anthropologist Paul Radin, 1883 to 1959. However, Mythogenesis, which is a largely revised redaction of my paper read in Ascona, Switzerland at the annual Iranos meeting of 1959, turns from the natural biological to the cultural historical aspect of the rise, flowering, and decline of a mythology, treating of a single American Indian legend and the circumstances of its origin, as well as the personal experiences of the visionary, the old medicine man through whose memory it has been preserved. The symbol without meaning was also presented first in Ascona at the Uranos meeting of 1957. It culminates the present series of explorations in what I have termed the mythological dimension. To take into account certain recent findings in the archaeological field, I have had to revise the second section of part one of this essay. Otherwise, however, the piece remains as written, when it served me as a preliminary sketch for the structuring of my four-volume history of mythological forms, The Masks of God. And then, finally, in The Secularization of the Sacred, which appeared in the first of what is expected to be an annual series of symposiums, The Religious Situation, 1968. My theme is of the present moment in its crisis of confrontation between Europe with its heritage of respect for individual creativity and the massive anonymities of a now mechanized, traditionally despotic Asia. The Fairy Tale, first published in 1944 as a commentary to the Pantheon edition of Grimm's Fairy Tales. The Work of the Brothers Grimm. Frau Katharina Wiemann, 1755 to 1815, was about 55 when the young Grimm brothers discovered her. She had married in 1777 a tailor of Niederzweren, a village near Kassel, and was now a mother and a grandmother. This woman, Wilhelm Grimm wrote in his preface to the first edition of their second volume, 1815, has a strong and pleasant face and a clear, sharp look in her eyes. In her youth she must have been beautiful. She retains fast in mind these old sagas, which talent, as she said, is not granted to everyone. For there be many that cannot keep in their heads anything at all. She recounts her stories thoughtfully, accurately, with uncommon vividness and evident delight, First, quite easily, but then, if required, over again, slowly, so that with a bit of practice, it is possible to take down her diction word for word. Much was recorded in this way, and its fidelity is unmistakable. Anyone believing that traditional materials are easily falsified and carelessly preserved and hence cannot survive over a long period should hear how close she always keeps to her story and how zealous she is for its accuracy. Never does she alter any part in repetition, and she corrects a mistake herself immediately she notices it. Among people who follow the old life ways without change, attachment to inherited patterns is stronger than we, impatient for variety, can realize. It was from such people that Jacob and Wilhelm collected through a period of years the materials for their books. Simple folk of the farms and villages round about, and in the spinning rooms and beer halls of Kassel. Many stories were received, too, from friends. In the notes it is set down frequently, from Dorchenwild in Kassel, or from Dorchen in the garden house. Dorothea Wild, later Wilhelm's wife, supplied over a dozen of the stories. Together with her five sisters, she had been grounded in fairy lore by an old nurse, the Alte Marie. Another family were the Hassenpflugs, who had arrived with a store of tales from Hanau. Still another, the Haxthausens, who resided in Westphalia. The brothers grubbed for materials also in medieval German manuscripts and in the folk books and collections from the time of Luther. The special distinction of the work of Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm, 1785-1863 and 1786-1859, was its scholarly regard for the sources. Earlier collectors had felt free to manipulate folk materials. The Grimms were concerned to let the speech of the people break directly into print. Among the romantics of the generation just preceding, folk poetry had been venerated profoundly. Novalis had pronounced the folk tale the primary and highest poetic creation of man. Schiller had written extravagantly, "Deeper meaning lies in the fairy tale of my childhood than in the truth that is taught by life." Sir Walter Scott had collected and studied the balladry of the Scottish border. Wordsworth had sung of the reaper. Yet no one before the Grimms had really acquiesced in the irregularities, the boorishness, the simplicity of the folk tale. Anthologists had arranged, restored, and tempered. Poets had built new masterpieces out of the rich raw material, but an essentially ethnographical approach no one had so much as conceived. The remarkable fact is that the Grimm brothers never developed their idea. They began with it full-blown as young students hardly out of law school. Jacob, browsing in the library of their favorite professor, the jurist Friedrich Karl von Savigny, had chanced on a selection of the German Minnesingers, and almost immediately their life careers had stood before them. Two friends, Clemens Brentano and Ludwig Achim von Arnim, who in 1805 had published in the romantic manner the first volumes of a collection of folk songs, Des Knaben Wunderhorn, gave the brothers valuable encouragement. Jacob and Wilhelm assisted with the latter volumes of the Wunderhorn and began collecting from their friends. But at the same time, they were seeking out, deciphering, and beginning to edit manuscripts from the Middle Ages. The Book of Fairy Tales represented only a fraction of their immediate project. It would be comparable, in a way, to the popular exhibition hall of an ethnological museum. In the offices upstairs, researches would be going forward which the larger public would hardly wish or know how to follow. The program proceeded against all odds. In 1806, the armies of Napoleon overran Kassel. "Those days," wrote Wilhelm, "of the collapse of all hitherto existing establishments will remain forever before my eyes." The ardor with which the studies in Old German were pursued helped overcome the spiritual depression. Undoubtedly, the world situation and the necessity to draw into the peacefulness of scholarship contributed to the reawakening of the long-forgotten literature. But not only did we seek something of consolation in the past, our hope, naturally, was that this course of ours should contribute somewhat to the return of a better day. While foreign persons, foreign manners, and a foreign, loudly spoken language promenaded the thoroughfares, and poor people staggered along the streets being led away to death, the brothers stuck to their work tables. to resurrect the present through the past. Jacob, in 1805, had visited the libraries of Paris. His ability to speak French now helped him to a small clerkship in the War Office. Two of his brothers were in the field with the Hussars. Just after his mother's death in 1808, he was appointed auditor to the State Council and superintendent of the private library of Jérôme Bonaparte, the puppet king of Westphalia. Thus, he was freed from economic worry, but had considerable to do. Volume 1 of the Nursery and Household Tales appeared the winter of Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, 1812. 2 years later, in the midst of the work on Volume 2, Jacob was suddenly dispatched to Paris to demand restitution of his city's library, which had been carried away by the French. Then in 1816, after attending the Congress of Vienna as Secretary of Legation, he was again dispatched to reclaim another treasure of books. He found the predicament not a little awkward. The librarian, a certain Monsieur Langlais, seeing him studying manuscripts in the bibliothèque, protested with indignation, "Nous ne devons plus souffrir ces Monsieur Grimm, qui vient tous les jours travailler ici et qui nous enlève pourtant nos manuscrits." Wilhelm was never as vigorous and positive as Jacob, but he was more gay and gentle. During the years of the collection, he suffered from a severe heart disorder, which for days riveted him to his room. The two were together all their lives. As children, they had slept in the same bed and worked at the same table. As students, they had had two beds and tables in the same room. Even after Wilhelm's marriage to Dorchenwild in 1825, Uncle Jacob shared the house, and in such harmony and community that one might almost imagine the children were common property. Thus, it is difficult to say with respect to their work where Jacob ended and Wilhelm began. The engraved portraits of the brothers reveal two very good-looking youths, clear-eyed with delicately modeled features. Wilhelm's forehead is the larger, his chin the sharper, his eyes look out from arched, slightly nettled brows. With firmer jaw, Jacob watches, and a sturdier, more relaxed poise. His hair is a shade darker, less curled and tousled. Their mouths, well-shaped, are identical. Both are shown with the soft, flaring, highly stocked collars and the wind-blown hair trim of the period. They are alert, sharp-nosed, sensitive-nostrilled, and immediately interest to the eye. In the labor on the fairy tales, Jacob supplied, apparently, the greater initiative, the stricter demands for scholarly precision, and a tireless zeal for collecting. Wilhelm told over the tales with sympathetic devotion and with exquisite judgment in the patient task of selecting, piecing together, and arranging. As late as 1809, they had considered the advisability of turning over the manuscripts to Brentano, but Jacob mistrusted their friend's habit of reworking traditional materials, shooting them full of personal fantasy, cutting, amplifying, recombining brilliantly, and always flavoring to the contemporary palate. He complained of the mishandling of the text of the Wunderhorn. The poet, however, thought the scholar a little dull and exhibited no interest whatsoever in the ideal of the chaste historical record. Achim von Arnim, on the other hand, aided and advised. Though he strove to persuade Jacob to relent a little here and there, he did not reject the brothers when they insisted on their program. It was he who found a printer for the collection, Georg Andreas Reimer, in Berlin. Volume 1 came out at Christmas time, 1812, with a dedication to Bettina, the wife of Achim von Arnim, for her little son, Johannes Freimund. In Vienna, the book was banned as a work of superstition, but elsewhere, in spite of the political tension of the times, it was eagerly received. Clemens Brentano declared that he found the unimproved materials slovenly and often very boring. Others complained of the impropriety of certain of the tales. Newspaper reviews were few and cold. Nevertheless, the book enjoyed immediate success and prospered. The brothers Grimm had produced, in an unpredicted way, the masterpiece which the whole Romantic movement in Germany had been intending. Von Arnim wrote to Wilhelm with quiet satisfaction, "You have collected propitiously and have sometimes right propitiously helped, which of course you don't let Jacob know." Not all the tales had come from such talented heads as that of the story wife of Niederzwerin. Some had been rather garbled. Many had been relayed by friends and had lost flavor. A few had been found in fragments, and these had to be matched. But Wilhelm had kept note of his adjustments, and their end had been not to embellish, but to bring out the lines of the story which the inferior informant had obscured. Furthermore, throughout the later editions, which appeared from year to year, the work of the careful, loving, improving hand could be increasingly discerned. Wilhelm's method, as contrasted with the procedures of the Romantics, was inspired by his increasing familiarity with the popular modes of speech. He noted carefully the words that the people preferred to use and their typical manners of descriptive narrative, and then, very carefully going over the story texts as taken from this or that raconteur, he chiseled away the more abstract, literary, or colorless turns, and fitted in such characteristic, rich phrases as he had gathered from the highways and the byways. Jacob at first demurred. But it was clear that the stories were gaining immensely by the patient devotion of the younger brother, and since Jacob, anyhow, was becoming involved in his grammatical studies, he gradually released to Wilhelm the whole responsibility. Even the first edition of Volume 2 was largely in the hands of Wilhelm. Thereafter, the work was completely his. Volume 2 appeared in January 1815, the brothers having received assistance from all sides. "The two of us gathered the first volume alone," Wilhelm wrote to a friend, "quite by ourselves and hence very slowly over a period of 6 years. Now things are going much better and more rapidly." The second edition was issued in 1819, improved and considerably enlarged, and with an introduction by Wilhelm on the nature of folk tales. Then, in 1822, appeared a third volume, a work of commentary, compiled partly from the notes of the earlier editions, but containing additional matter as well as a thoroughgoing comparative historical study. The brothers published a selection of 50 favorites in 1825, and in 1837 released a third edition of the two-volume original, again amplified and improved. Still further betterments were to be noted in the editions of 1840, 1843, 1850, and 1857. Translations in Danish, Swedish, and French came almost immediately. Presently in Dutch, English, Italian, Spanish, Czech, Polish, Russian, Bulgarian, Hungarian, Finnish, Estonian, Hebrew, Armenian, and Esperanto. Tales derived from the Grimm collection itself, directly or indirectly, have since been recorded among the natives of Africa, Mexico, and the South Seas. The types of story. The first effect of the work was a transformation throughout the world of the scholarly attitude toward the productions of the folk. A new humility before the informant becomes everywhere perceptible after the date 1812. Exactitude, not beautification, becomes thereafter the first requirement, touching up the unforgivable sin. Furthermore, the number and competence of the collectors greatly and rapidly increased. Field workers, armed with pad and pencil, marched forth to every corner of the earth. Solid volumes today stand ranged along the shelf from Switzerland, Frisia, Holland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Iceland and the Faroes, England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, France, Italy, Corsica, Malta, Portugal, and Spain, the Basques, the Rhaeto-Romanic Mountaineers, the modern Greeks, Romanians, Albanians, Slovenes, Serb-Croatians, Bulgarians, Macedonians, Czechs, Slovaks, Serbs, and Poles, Great, White and Little Russians, Lithuanians, Latvians, Finns, Laps and Estonians, Cheremis, Mordvinians, Votyaks and Syrianians, Gypsies and Hungarians, Turks, Kazan Tatars, Chuvash and Bashkirs, Kalmuks, Buryats, Vogels and Ostyaks, Yakuts, Siberian Tatars, the people of the Caucasus, the populations of India and Iran, Mesopotamia, Syria, the Arabian Desert, Tibet, Turkestan, Java and Sumatra, Borneo and the Celebes, the Philippines, Burma, Siam, Annam, China, Korea and Japan, Australia, Melanesia, Micronesia, Polynesia, the continent of Africa, South, Middle and North America. Still, unpublished archives accumulate in provincial, national and international institutes. Where there was a lack, there is now such abundance that the problem is how to deal with it, how to get the mind around it, and what to think. In this ocean of story, a number of kinds of narrative are encompassed. Many of the collections of the so-called primitive materials include myths, that is to say, religious recitations conceived as symbolic of the play of eternity in time. These are rehearsed not for diversion, but for the spiritual welfare of the individual or community. Legends also appear, that is, reviews of a traditional history or of episodes from such a history, so rendered as to permit mythological symbolism to inform human event and circumstance. Whereas myths present in pictorial form cosmogonic and ontological intuitions, legends refer to the more immediate life and setting of the given society. Something of the religious power of myth may be regarded as effective in legend, in which case the native narrator must be careful concerning the circumstances of his recitation, lest the power break astray. Myths and legends may furnish entertainment, but they are essentially tutorial. Tales, on the other hand, are frankly pastime. Fireside tales, winter night's tales, nursery tales, coffee house tales, sailor yarns, pilgrimage and caravan tales to pass the endless nights and days. The most ancient written records and the most primitive tribal circles attest alike to man's hunger for the good story. And every kind of thing has served. Myths and legends of an earlier period, now discredited or no longer understood, their former power broken yet still potent to charm, have supplied much of the raw material for what now passes simply as animal tale, fairy tale, and heroic or romantic adventure. The giants and gnomes of the Germans, the little people of the Irish, the dragons, knights, and ladies of Arthurian romance, were once the gods and demons of the Green Isle and the European continent. Similarly, the divinities of the primitive Arabians appear as jinn in the story world of Islam. Tales of such origin are regarded with differing degrees of seriousness by the various people who recount them, and they can be received by the sundry members of the audience, severally with superstitious awe, nostalgia for the days of belief, ironic amusement, or simple delight in the marvels of imagination and intricacies of plot. But no matter what the atmosphere of belief, the stories, insofar as they are now tales, are composed primarily for amusement. They are reshaped in terms of dramatic contrast, narrative suspense, repetition, and resolution. Certain characteristic opening and closing formulas set apart from the common world the timeless, placeless realm of fairy. Once upon a time, in the days of good King Arthur, 1,000 years ago tomorrow, long, long ago when Brahmadatta was the ruler of Benares, and so they lived happily ever after. That's all. A mouse did run, the story is done. So there they remain, happy and contented, while we stand barefoot as pack asses and lick our teeth. Bow bow bended, my story's ended. If you don't like it, you may mend it. A handsome conclusion is attributed to the Zanzibar Swahili. If the story was beautiful, the beauty belongs to us all. If it was bad, the fault is mine only who told it. Prose is the normal vehicle of story, but at critical points, little rhymes commonly appear. Looking glass on the wall. Who in this land is the fairest of all? Turn back, young maiden dear. 'Tis a murderer's house you enter here. Peace, peace, my dear little giants, I have a thought of ye, something I have brought for ye. Little duck, dost thou see, Hansel and Gretel are waiting for thee. There's never a plank or bridge in sight, take us across on thy back so white. In Arabian tales, and less commonly in European, the prose of the text slips momentarily into rhyme. Thereupon sat a lady bright of blee, with brow beaming brilliantly, the dream of philosophy, whose eyes were fraught with Babel's grammary, and her eyebrows were arched for archery. They all lived happy and died happy, and never drank out of a dry cappy. Now I had an army of 1,000,000 bridles, men of warrior mien, with forearms strong and keen, armed with spears and mail coats sheen and swords that gleam. In the lovely French medieval chant fable, A Cousin et Nicolette, verse passages regularly alternate with prose. In the bardic lays that serve to entertain the heroes in the mead hall, in the long epics woven in later times, and in the ballads of the folk, narrative goes into verse entirely. The spell of rhythm and rhyme is the spell of once upon a time. And as the cup went round merrily, quote the porter to the calendars, "And you, O brother mine, have ye no story or rare adventure to amuse us withal?" The empty hour is as gladly filled with a good personal adventure as with a fragment of traditional wonder. Hence, the world of actual life as caught in anecdote, paced and timed to fix and justify attention, has contributed to the great category of the tale. The anecdote may range from the ostensibly truthful or only slightly exaggerated to the frankly unbelievable. In the latter range, it mingles readily with sheer invention, the joke, merry tale, and ghost adventure. Again, it can unite with the mythological stuff of traditional romance and thus acquire some of the traits of legend. A distinct and relatively recently developed category is the fable. The best examples are the Greek and medieval collections attributed to Aesop and the Oriental of the Brahmins, Buddhists, and Jains. The fable is didactic. It is not, like myth, a revelation of transcendental mysteries, but a clever illustration of a political or ethical point. Fables are witty and not to be believed, but understood. Under the single heading Märchen, the Germans popularly comprehend the whole range of the folktale. The Brothers Grimm, therefore, included in their collection folk stories of every available variety. Scholars since their day have analyzed the assortment and classified the tales according to type. The history of the tales. The patterns of the folktale are much the same throughout the world. This circumstance has given rise to a long and intricate learned discussion. By and large, it is now fairly agreed that the general continuity and an occasional correspondence in detail can be referred to the psychological unity of the human species, but that over this ground a profuse and continuous passing along of tales from mouth to ear and by book has been taking place not for centuries only, but for millenniums, and over immense reaches of the globe. Hence the folklore of each area must be studied for its peculiar history. Every story, every motif, in fact, has had its adventurous career. The Grimm brothers regarded European folklore as the detritus of old Germanic belief. The myths of ancient time had disintegrated, first into heroic legend and romance, last into these charming treasures of the nursery. But in 1859, the year of Wilhelm's death, a Sanskrit scholar, Theodore Benfey, demonstrated that a great portion of the lore of Europe had come, through Arabic, Hebrew, and Latin translations, directly from India, and this as late as the 13th century A.D., Since Benfey's time, the evidence for a late polygenetic development of the folktale of Christian Europe has become abundant and detailed. The scholars of the English anthropological school at the close of the 19th century, E.B. Taylor, Andrew Lang, E.S. Hartland, and others, believed that the irrational elements of fairy lore were grounded in savage superstition, totemism, cannibalism, taboo, and the external soul they discovered on every page. But today it is clear that such irrationalities are as familiar to modern European dream life as to society on the Congo, and so we are no longer disposed to run a tale back to the Paleolithic caves simply because the heroine marries a gazelle or eats her mother. Yet in a few of the stories of the Grimm collection, actual vestiges of primitive ways can be identified with reasonable assurance. And in perhaps half a dozen others, signs persist from the barbaric period of the migrations. A crisis in the history of the European folk tradition becomes apparent about the 10th century AD. A quantity of late classical matter was being imported from the Mediterranean by the itinerant entertainers, minstrels, and pranksters who came swarming from the sunny south to infest the pilgrim routes and present themselves at castle doors. And not only minstrels, but missionaries too were at work. The fierce warrior ideals of earlier story were submitting to a new piety and sentimental didactic. Slandered virtue is triumphant. Patience is rewarded. Love endures. There seems, however, to have prevailed a comparative poverty of invention until the 12th century, when the matter of India and the matter of Ireland found their ways to the fields of Europe. This was the period of the Crusades and the rise of Arthurian romance, the former opening Europe wide to the civilization of the Orient, the latter conjuring from the realm of Celtic fairy a wild wonderworld of princesses enchanted in sleep, castles solitary in the forest adventurous, dragons steaming in rimy caverns, Merlin magic, Morgan le Fay, cackling hags transmuted by a kiss into the damsel of the world. Europe inherited nearly everything of its fairyland from the imagination of the Celt. Shortly after this time came the Hindu Panchatantra. The work had been translated from Sanskrit into Persian in the 6th century AD, from Persian into Arabic in the 8th, and from Arabic into Hebrew around the middle of the 13th. About 1270, John of Capua turned the Hebrew into Latin, and from this Latin version the book passed into German and Italian. A Spanish translation had been made from the Arabic in 1251, and English was later drawn from the Italian. Individual stories became popular in Europe and were then rapidly assimilated. "Out of the literary works," wrote Benfey, "the tales went to the people, and from the people they returned, transformed, into literary collections. Then back they went to the people again, etc., and it was principally through this cooperative action that they achieved national and individual spirit, that quality of national validity and individual unity which contributes to, not a few of them, their high poetical worth." A wonderful period opened in the 13th century. With the passing of the gallant days of the Great Crusades, the aristocratic taste for verse romance declined, and the lusty prose of the late medieval towns moved into its own. Prose compendiums of traditional lore began appearing, filled with every kind of gathered anecdote and history of wonder, vast, immeasurable compilations which the modern scholar has hardly explored. A tumbling, broad, inexhaustible flood of popular merry tales, misadventures, hero, saint, and devil legends, animal fables, mock heroics, slapstick jokes, riddles, pious allegories, and popular ballads burst abruptly into manuscript and carried everything before it. Compounded with themes from the cloister and the castle, mixed with elements from the Bible and from the heathenesse of the Orient, as well as the deep pre-Christian past, the wonderful hurly-burly broke into the stonework of the cathedrals, grinned from the stained glass, twisted and curled in humorous grotesque in and out of the letters of illuminated manuscripts, appeared in tapestries, on saddles and weapons, on trinket caskets, mirrors and combs. This was the first major flourishing in Europe of a literature of the people. From right and left the materials came. To left and right they were flung forth again, sealed with the sign of the late Gothic so that no matter what the origin, they were now the recreation of the European folk. Much of this matter found its way into the literary works of the late Middle Ages, the Reformation and the Renaissance, Boccaccio, Chaucer, Hans Sachs, Les Cent Nouvelles Nouvelles, etc., and then back, reshaped, to the people. The period of abundance continued to the time of the Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648. Finally, in France, at the court of Louis XIV, a vogue commenced for the delicate refashioning of fairy tales and fables, inspired in part by a new French translation of a later Persian rendering of the Panchatantra, and in part by Antoine Galland's rendition of the Arabian Thousand Nights and One Night. The pastime yielded a plentiful harvest of freshly wrought, delicate pieces, La Fontaine, Perrault, the 41 volumes of the Cabinet des Fées. Many were taken over by the people and crossed the Rhine. Thus, by the time the Grimm brothers arrived to begin their collection, much material had overlain the remote mythology of the early tribes. Tales from the Four Quarters, inventions from every level of society and all stages of Western history, were commingled. Nevertheless, as they observed, a homogeneity of style and character pervades the total inheritance. A continuous process of recreation, a kind of spiritual metabolism, has so broken the original structures in assimilating them to the living civilization that only the most meticulous and skillful observation, analysis, and comparative research can discover their provenience and earlier state. The Grimm brothers regarded this rich composition as a living unit and sought to probe its past. The modern scientist, on the other hand, searches the unit for its elements, then ferrets these to their remote sources. From the contemporary work, we receive a more complex impression of the processes of culture than was possible in the period of the Grimms. Let us turn, therefore, to the problem of the individual tale, the migratory element that enters our system and becomes adapted to our style of existence. What is its history? What can happen to it during the course of its career? Passing from Orient to Occident, surviving the revolutions of history and the long attrition of time, traversing the familiar bounds of language and belief. The favorite now of a Saracen king, now of a hard warrior, now of a Capuchin monk, now of old Marie, the tale undergoes kaleidoscopic mutations. The first problem of research is to identify, fix, and characterize the key complex, the formal principle of the story's entity, that without which the story would not be. As the story then is followed throughout its peregrination, it is observed to assimilate to itself the materials offered from land to land. It changes like a chameleon, puts on the colors of its background, lives and shapes itself to the requirements of the moment. Such a tale, writes an American authority, is at the same time a definite entity and an abstraction. It is an entity in the particular form in which it happens to be recorded at any moment. It is an abstraction in the sense that no two versions ever exactly agree, and that consequently the tale lives only in endless mutations. In the life course of any given version of a tale, a number of typical accidents may occur. A detail may be forgotten. A foreign trait may become naturalized, an obsolete modernized. A general term, animal, may become specialized, mouse, or vice versa, a special term, generalized. The order of events may be rearranged. The personages may become confused, or the acts confused, or in some other way the traits of the story may cross-influence each other. Persons and things may become multiplied, particularly by the numbers 3, 5, and 7. Many animals may replace one, polyzoism. Animals may assume human shape, anthropomorphism, or vice versa. Animals may become demons, or vice versa. The narrator can appear as hero, egomorphism. Furthermore, the story may be amplified with new materials. Such materials are generally derived from other folktales. The expansion may take place at any point, but the beginning and end are the most likely to be amplified. Several tales can be joined into one. Finally, the inventiveness of an individual narrator may lead to intentional variations, for better or for worse. The serious study of popular story began in Europe with the Romantics. With the Grimm brothers, the science came of age. With the foundation in Helsingfors in 1907 of the Finnish Society of the Folklore Fellows, the now colossal subject was coordinated for systematic research over the entire world. The technique of the geographical historical method, perfected by the associates of this pivotal group, enables the modern scholar to retrace the invisible path of the spoken tale practically to the doorstep of the inventor, over the bounds of states, languages, continents, even across oceans and around the globe. The work has required the cooperation of the scholars of the five continents. The international distribution of the materials has demanded an international research. Yet the work started in the usual way of folklore studies, as a labor of local patriotic pride. About the middle of the 19th century, a strong nationalistic movement had begun to mature in Finland. Buffeted for 500 years between Sweden and Russia, the little nation had been annexed in 1809 by Tsar Alexander I. Since the close of the 18th century, Swedish had been the official academic language. A group of young patriots now began to agitate for the restoration of the native spirit and the native tongue. Elias Lönnrot, 1802 to 1884, a country physician and student of Finnish philology, collected ballads and folktales among the people. His work was a northern echo of the labors of the Brothers Grimm. Having gathered a considerable body of folk poetry around the legendary heroes Väinämöinen, Ilmarinen, Lemminkainen, and Kullervo, he composed these in coordinated sequence and cast them in a uniform verse. Thus, in 1835, he published the first edition of what has since become known as the folk epic of Finland, the Kalevala, the Land of Heroes. Julius Krohn, 1835 to 1888, the first student at the university to presume to present his graduate thesis in Finnish, devoted himself to the study of the folk tradition, and in particular, to the materials gathered by Lönnrot in the Kalevala. He discovered that among the ballads and popular stories of the Swedes, Russians, Germans, Tatars, etc., many of the motifs of Lönnrot's epic reappeared, but in variant combinations. The Kalevala, therefore, could not be studied all of a piece. Its elements had to be traced down separately. With this discovery, he took the first step toward the development of the Finnish geographical historical method. Julius Krohn next found that not all the Finnish examples of a given theme could be compared, trait for trait, with the foreign versions. Only what seemed to him to be the oldest of the Finnish forms closely resembled those of the neighboring lands. He concluded that the materials of the native epic had entered Finland from without and had undergone within the country gradual modification. Furthermore, and finally, Julius Krohn perceived that each of the native modifications seemed to be limited in its geographical distribution. He took care, therefore, to keep precise note of the geographical sources as well as chronological relationships of his materials. In this way, he was enabled to study the transformation of the motifs of a tale in its passage from mouth to mouth over the land and through the years. First, I sift and arrange the different variants according to chronology and topography, he wrote to the Hungarian philologist P. Hunfalvi in 1884, because I have discovered that only in this way is it possible to distinguish the original elements from the later editions. With respect to the Kalevala, Julius Krohn concluded that neither was it a very old legend, nor were its materials originally Finnish. The narrative elements had arrived on the waves of a culture tide that had streamed over Europe through the centuries. Stemming from the gardens of the East and the fertile valleys of antiquity, they had crossed southern Europe largely by word of mouth, then turned eastward again to the regions of the Slavs and Tatars, whence they had passed to the peoples of the North. And as each folk had received, it had developed, reinterpreted, and amplified, and then handed along the inheritance to the neighbor. Thus, in Finland, as in Germany, what had begun as the study of a national tradition developed inevitably into the review of an international tradition. And the scholarship that had started in patriotic fervor opened immediately into a worldwide collaboration. The son of Julius Krohn, Karl Krohn, applied the geographical method developed by his father to the special problem of the folk tale, and it was he who, in 1907, in collaboration with German and Scandinavian scholars, founded the research society that since his time has coordinated the work of many regions. To illustrate the way in which the research has been carried on, an index of folk tale types was issued in 1911 by Antti Aarn. Each class was subdivided, and under each head appeared a directory of examples. Coordinated to Aarn's index, then, were published a series of special catalogs for a number of folk traditions. Finnish, Estonian, Finnish-Swedish, Flemish, Norwegian, Lap, Livonian, Romanian, Hungarian, Icelandic, Spanish, and Prussian. For each culture, all the available tales from the various published and unpublished archives were classified according to the principles of Aarn's index. Thus, an order was beginning to be brought into fluid chaos. Another type of work undertaken was that of the monograph. A monograph is a special study devoted to the tracing of a single tale through its twists and turns, disappearances and reappearances, over the globe and through the corridors of time. The technique for the preparation of such a work has been described as follows. 1. The scholar undertaking to write a monograph on any folk narrative folktale, saga, legend, anecdote, must know all the extant versions, variants of this narrative, whether printed or unprinted, and no matter what the language in which they appear. 2. He must compare all these versions, carefully, trait by trait, and without any previously formed opinion. 3. During the investigation, he must always keep in mind the place and time of the rendering of each of the variants. The homeland of any given folktale can generally be judged to be the region in which the richest harvest of variants appears. Furthermore, where the structure of the tale is most consistent and where customs and beliefs may serve to illuminate the meaning of the tale. The farther a folktale wanders from its home, the greater the damage to its configurations. The researches of the Finnish Folklore School were supported and extended by an originally independent enterprise in Germany. In 1898, Professor Hermann Grimm, the son of Wilhelm, turned over to Johannes Bolt, 1858 to 1937, the unpublished materials of his father and his uncle, with the hope that a new edition might be prepared of the commentaries to the nursery and household tales. These commentaries had first appeared as appendices to the volumes of 1812 and 1815, then as a special volume in 1822, and finally in a third edition, 1856. Professor Bolt collated, trait by trait, with all the tales and variants gathered by the Grimms, everything that could be drawn from the modern archives. He enlisted in the enterprise Professor Georg Polivka of Prague, who assisted in the analysis of the Slavic analogues. During the course of the next 34 years, the opus grew to 5 closely printed volumes. The original work of the Grimms, which had opened a rich century of folk studies, collection, and interpretation, was brought by this labor to stand securely in the midpoint of the modern field, so that the nursery and household tales are today, as they were the moment they left the press, the beginning and the middle, if nowise the end, of the study of the literature of the people. The classification of the stories according to the above-described stages of development has been adapted from that supplied by Friedrich von der Leyen to his edition of the Nursery and Household Tales, Jena, 1912. It is a very useful listing and will enable the reader to explore in his own good way the history and stratifications of the inexhaustible text. The Question of Meaning. The Grimm brothers, Max Müller, Andrew Lang, and others have pointed out that folk tales are monstrous, irrational, and unnatural, both as to the elements of which they are composed and as to the plots that unify these elements. Since a tale may have a different origin from its elements, two questions pose themselves. What is the origin and meaning of the motifs? What is the origin and meaning of the tales? The motifs. Many of the incidents of the merry tales, jokes, yarns, tall stories, and anecdotes are simply comical and clever inventions spun from life. These offer no problem. The monstrous, irrational, and unnatural incidents, however, are of a kind with those of myth. Indeed, they are frequently derived from myth. They must be explained as myth is explained. But then, how is myth explained? The reply varies according to the authority. Euhemerus, a Greek writer of the 4th century BC, noting that Alexander the Great, shortly after his death, was already appearing in legend as a demigod, propounded the view that the gods are only great mortals deified. Snorri Sturluson, 1179-1241, in the preface to his Prose Edda, explained in the same way the pagan divinities of the Norse. This theory, called euhemerism, has its advocates to this day. Among the Indo-Germanic philologists in the period of the ascendancy of Max Müller, it was believed that myths were originally sentimental descriptions of nature. Man half-consciously read the tragedy of his own life in the birth of the sun, its kissing of the dew to death, its culmination, descent, and disappearance into the arms of night. Because of the fact that Indo-European nouns are either masculine or feminine, the descriptions tended to personify their objects. And because of the fact that the language was evolving, the original references of the personifying nouns were presently forgotten, so that the words were finally taken to be personal names. For example, such a metaphorical name for the sun as Cephalos, the head of light, presently lost its meaning and was thought to refer to a human youth, and correspondingly the fading dew, Procris, bride of the head, became a mortal girl of tragical demise. One more step, the names might become confused with those of actual historical heroes, whereupon the myth would be transformed into a legend. Mueller's theory was the most elaborate attempt to account for the mechanics of personification. Among the anthropologists, it was, more easily, simply assumed that savages and poets